This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. When visiting Sabah for the first time back in 1994, Dr. Mark Ankrenaz, together with Dr. Isabel Lackman, realized that many orangutans were hanging around in disturbed and overlogged forests, and they decided to establish an intensive study site in the fragmented forests of Lower Kinabatangan to study orangutan adaptation to habitat disturbance, and thus the NGO Hutan was born. Then in 1998, they established the Kinabatangan Orangutan Conservation Program, or KOCP, in the village of Sukau, and switched from a purely scientific approach to a more holistic one by incorporating the needs and aspirations of the local communities. So how has this approach worked in favour of orangutan conservation in the area? So following International Orangutan Day 2021, which was just celebrated last week on the 19th of August, Dr. Mark joins me now to discuss more. And he is, of course, the Scientific Director of Hutan and the Co-Director of KOCP. Welcome, Mark. How are you today?
Hi, good afternoon. Yes, I'm doing fine.
Thank you so much for joining me today. So let's get to know you a little bit better, Mark. I know that your expertise is pretty wide-ranging. You know, I was reading it includes wildlife research, medicine, population management, policy formulation. You've got over 25 to 30 years of experience in wildlife range countries. Tell me how you got interested in all of this sort of work.
Well, the first thing people need to know is that I'm French. This, I guess you can hear that straightforward. I was born in Paris. So Paris is not exactly a place where you see wildlife, isn't it? Because it's a large mega city. Mm-hmm. But I don't know why, since as long as I can remember, I was always fascinated with wildlife, wild animals. I always loved animals, but I was really, really, my attention was focused on wildlife. So, of course, I was dreaming of elephants, of gorillas, of whales, all these wild animals that were not found there in Paris, except in zoos. And as you said, I have a few years of experience now. So when I was doing my universities in Paris at this time, for 30 years ago, there was not much biodiversity conservation, was not really something that existed yet. So I decided to go for veterinary medicine. I was not so interested in doing the medical work with domestic animals, but it was a way for me to get a degree and to start achieving my dream, which was to be with wildlife. And so I started to work in Africa, worked with species like gorillas, like buffaloes, elephants, stuff like this, moved to Saudi Arabia, where I was in charge of the Arabian Oryx Reintroduction Program for the kingdom. Mm-hmm. Spent 3 years in the Middle East working with wildlife over there. And then with Isabel Lackman, we moved to Malaysia. And I have been living here since 1998 now.
And what brought you and Dr. Isabel Lackman, right? You mentioned you both of you co-founded Hutan. What brought you to Malaysia and Sabah in particular and led you to start the NGO Hutan?
Yeah, well, a few things. It was a combination of a few parameters. First, I'm super, super, super excited about elephants. And Isabel is super excited about orangutan. So if you want to work an orangutan and elephant at the same time, you have not much choice. Sabah is the only place. So actually, it was more by chance that we ended up in Sabah. Mm-hmm. We visited the state in 94, the first time, and we had in mind to try to set up a conservation project somewhere. I wanted to go back to Africa, which was my first love in terms of conservation. Isabel, as I said, was interested in Southeast Asia in orangutan. So we visited the state, and we saw a few places, and we were really, really impressed by what we saw in Kinabatangan. Mm. At this time, so I'm speaking about nearly 30 years ago, Kinabatangan was a landscape where you had people and wildlife sharing the same ecosystem. And to me, this was new because I was used to work in places like in Africa, like in Middle East, or even in Europe, where if you want to see wildlife, you have to move away from people. And if you want to work with people, you don't see wildlife. But Kinabatangan was offering a different perspective where we realized that it would be possible to work with people and at the same time with wildlife because they were sharing the same ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And this is why, actually, this is a combination of all of these things that convinced us that Kinabatangan was a place we really wanted to try to design our project.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you said, you've been there for, you know, about 30, almost 30 years now. You know, talk to me about the landscape in Kinabatangan, where you are right now, right? What is the biodiversity there like? What is the ecosystem like? And you know, in all these years, how much of it has changed?
So the Kinabatangan, for those of you who haven't been to Sabah, is the largest river in the state of Sabah. And we are in the lowland of Kinabatangan. Sukhao is really it's close to the sea, actually. Mm-hmm. It's 20 kilometers straight line from the sea, meaning that we are in the floodplain. So the landscape is super flat. Okay. Mm-hmm. This place used to be covered with forest. So different types of forest, ranging from swamp forest to dry forest, semi-inundated forest, mangrove forest, and so forth. And because it's a floodplain, the soil of Kinabatangan is super rich. Mm-hmm. And this is important to know because as of today, Kinabatangan has been exploited by people for centuries. And most of the forest we find in the floodplain has been converted to other types of land uses like agriculture, like palm oil plantation. And because of the soil, because of the richness of the soil, yeah. Kinabatangan is the best production area for palm oil in the entire country, Federation of Malaysia. Mm-hmm. And this is important because since the soil is so rich, the vegetation there is rich. And the original forests of Kinabatangan were extremely rich and diverse as well. So originally in Kinabatangan, you had a lot of animals, high diversity of species and many, 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 many animals there. So over the past 30, 40 years, most of the forest has been replaced with agriculture, as I said, meaning that today, less than 10% of the entire floodplain is still covered with forest. Mm. And so over the past 25 years, we have seen this process happening.
Okay.
Meaning losing forest, the forest getting more and more fragmented. But still, what is quite amazing is that Kinabatangan remains a hot spot for biodiversity. If you go to the floodplain today, you still see a lot of animals. Although the forest is degraded, although the forest is fragmented, we still have a lot of wildlife because the soil of the floodplain is so rich and so is able to sustain a thriving ecosystem.
Mm, and I suppose that's also why you continue to work there, right? There is still a lot that can be done despite, you know, all the crazy, you know, amounts of development that's happening there and all the land conversion that's happening there.
Yeah, because Kinabatangan is really a unique place, and although the soil is rich and sustain its ecosystems, the problem is that there is a lot of human activities and there is a lot of degradation happening, a lot of fragmentation happening. In itself, this is really jeopardizing the viability of the animals. And so, yeah, we are trying to find ways to secure this place for the future generation.
Yeah.
Because it's an amazing area.
And that's where Hutan comes in, right? Well, actually, you've got a lot of programs under Hutan. Tell me a little bit about that. You know, how would you describe the work that Hutan carries out?
Yeah. So our mission, our vision is actually to design ways for people and wildlife to coexist together in the same environment, okay? In other words, we want to manage biodiversity in a multiple-use landscape, in a landscape where you don't only have protected forest, but also forest exploited for timber, for example, and other types of land uses, including agriculture, including villages, including whatever people do in this landscape. So we are super interested in this because, well, if we look at the situation today, we are more and more people on this earth, and there is less and less space available for wildlife and biodiversity. So to me, it's a no-brainer that if we want to save many species in the long term, we need to find ways for these species to coexist with people. Or I should rephrase that. We need to find ways for people to coexist with wildlife. Because here, of course, it's always the same. It's always the people who are the disturbing element in the equation. And so this is what we want to do. So at the beginning, when we started Hutan with Isabel, our idea was to study if orangutan was able to survive in disturbed forest. Mm. 30 years ago, the scientists didn't believe it was possible for orangutan to survive outside of primary forest, meaning that at this time, people thought that as soon as you disturb the forest for timber, for example, orangutans are gone. And I was based in France, I thought the same, because I didn't know what was an orangutan in the wild. And that's why when we visited Sabah the first time in 1994, and we saw so many orangutan in Kinabatangan, in a place they shouldn't be there because Kinabatangan was already exploited, degraded, fragmented. We were really, really, really surprised and curious about this situation. So we decided to really study if these animals could survive and how long and breed and so forth. And it's, in terms of conservation, it's a very important question to answer because, and we'll talk about it maybe later, today the vast majority of wild orangutan population are found outside of primary forest. Mm. They are found in disturbed forests, in forests that are or have been exploited by people. So it's important to know if these animals can survive in a forest that is exploited or not by people. So this is what brought us in Sukao, in Kinabatangan, I mean, to really study this particular research question about orangutan adaptation to habitat disturbance. And of course, soon enough, we realized that if we really wanted to do something for this species, we had to expand the range of our activities. And this is what we did.
And the way you expanded it was to progress into the development of the Kinabatangan Orangutan Conservation Program. Am I correct? The KOCP. Yeah. How and why did that? Tell me about that. How did you get into that?
Yeah, it happened on its own, actually. So the first thing we did in the 1998 when we started the work was to hire a few people from the village to go with us and to study orangutan. It mm-hmm. was really interesting because they were not scientists, of course. We hardly speak any Malay at this time. And so it was really a learning experience for all of us. And of course, it was really surprising for villagers to see two French scientists coming all the way from France to follow orangutan in the forest. They really didn't understand why we would do that. And to pay them to come with us in the forest, this was beyond belief. But they started to work with us. And very soon we realized that in Kinabatangan, the problem was not really orangutan, but people had problems with other species like elephants, for example, or like dwindling fisheries and this kind of things. And we realized that if we really wanted to get the interest and the support of the community for orangutan conservation, we really needed to understand them better and to understand what were their problems, their issues, their aspiration, and all together to try to find solution to this. And so this is why from our pure orangutan research approach, very soon we started to develop other activities. So one of the first one was, for example, to work on the issue of human-elephant conflict. Mm-hmm. Because at this time, you had a lot of problems with elephants coming into people's crops or local graveyards. And elephants mm-hmm. would come into the local graveyards and destroy or disturb the grave of okay. the families of the people buried there. And it was, of course, distressful to the community. And as long as this problem was not solved, as I said just now, it was completely impossible to get the support of the community toward elephant conservation or orangutan conservation. And so we started to work on these issues and to find solutions to these issues. And then we realized that kids, they were not necessarily aware of the value of what was living around them. So we developed educational awareness activities. And then we realized that a lot of people had lost their source of income because of dwindling fisheries, for example. So we developed new source of alternative livelihood to sustain them. My point here is to say that we soon realized, Isabel and I and the team we were working with, that to do conservation, we need to involve these local communities, these villagers, and we need to show them the value of doing conservation. Conservation is not only about wildlife, it's primarily about people too.
And were they very open to, you know, to your suggestions? You know, were they very open to collaboration? Sometimes they might feel like, you know, who are you foreigners coming and telling me what to do? You know, how did you mitigate any of those sorts of issues that might have arisen?
It's a very good question. And we did a lot of mistakes, and I guess that we still do mistakes. But I think that, to be successful, you have to be super humble and to not come in a place you don't know with your own solution. So what we understood very, very, very soon the hard way. So then we started to spend time with the community and just listen to them. And then, as I said just now, I tried to understand their aspiration and their issues and work together toward the solution. It never worked to come to a place and tell people what they should do or tell them, oh, give some capacity building and give them a tool for them to be better. It doesn't work. Mm-hmm. The only thing that works with my own experience is to really spend time with people and go together. You have to build a trust, and this takes time. And unless you build this trust, all what you're going to try is going to fail at some point.
Okay. All right. I'm speaking today to Dr. Marc Encrenaz. He's the scientific director for the French NGO Hutan. He's also the co-director of the Kinabatangan Orangutan Conservation Project. And we're talking about the work that he does together with his team over in Sukau in Sabah. When we come back after this quick break, we're just going to find out more about some of the challenges and successes, you know, that Hutan has gone through and experienced over these last almost 30 years. Keep it right here on Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs. Joining me on the line today, all the way from Sabah, is Dr. Marc Encrenaz. He's the scientific director of the NGO Hutan. He's also the co-director of the Kinabatangan Orangutan Conservation Project. And we're talking about the work that they do. We're focusing a little bit on orangutan since it was International Orangutan Day last week. So we're finding out more about the work that, Marc and his team does in orangutan conservation. So before the break, Marc, you were talking a lot about, you know, how community buy-in was the most important thing, right? Without it, there would have been no success, in all the projects that you are doing. And you sort of, outlined, you know, why you think involving village communities is essential, right, in devising sustainable conservation strategies. But I also understand that you also complement this strategy by collaborative approaches with the government and private industries as well, right? How do you work with those stakeholders?
Yeah, actually, once again, it's a no-brainer. I mean, these days where there was enough room for wildlife to thrive without any human interference is over, especially when we consider large species like the orangutan or the elephants in Borneo. Here it would be the tapir, the tiger, or the elephants in West Malaysia, for example. Mm-hmm. Well, we realize now, we know that these species need vast landscape to survive. So the cornerstone for conservation is to create protected areas. We need protected areas and we need to create more of those. However, for these large species that need a large landscape to survive, protected areas will never be large enough. They will always, these animals will always roam outside of this network of protected areas. Yeah. And so they will go in places that are used by people. If we want to protect this animal, if we want to do conservation, we need to manage this species wherever they are, protected areas or not. So inside the non-protected areas, you need to work with whoever is using this type of land, be it local communities, be it the private industries, agriculture, tourism, mining, and so forth. And of course, the local government as well. Conservation cannot achieve anything unless you have a strong backup from all stakeholders, ranging from the local communities to the local government, of course, because the government is giving the frame for our intervention. Local communities are there. They are the guardian of the wildlife. They are there. They are living there. They are going to be there for the longest time, as are a lot of the private industry working there. Let's say Palmol Plantation in Kinabatangan is there for 99 years or even more. So there are people who are there for the longest time. So you need to engage with them to try to improve what is happening on the ground. Because this is where orangutan, elephants, and other wildlife species will come sooner or later.
And was that also something that was quite a difficult thing to establish, you know, those connections, those conversations? I remember speaking to another conservationist before, and he was saying that, you know, everybody wants to do the right thing, but it's just that, you know, they weren't having the correct conversations together. It was always like, you know, it was a conservationist pitting against the plantation owners, for example, the businesses, but nobody actually came together to have a proper conversation. Was that something that you were quite successful in doing?
Well, definitely, it's a huge difficulty. It's very difficult to engage with unlikely partners. Of course, if I am an orangutan conservationist, and if you look at how internationally people are considering the palm oil industry, for example, and the relation with the orangutan, it's difficult for me to engage directly with a grower because they will look at me as the enemy. And the same for me, it will be difficult to engage with them directly because there is the trust that is necessary to build something is not there. Okay, so this is what we need to break. We need to establish trust. And it's very, very, very difficult because, as I said, conservation is a very complex issue anyway. Mm-hmm. So I do think, and the way we try to do it at Bhutan is we do our work and we try to do it as best as we can, and people see the results by themselves. We don't point fingers to anyone. We just assess the situation. This is my scientific background. Here we assess the situation, and then we try to identify options to mitigate issues, find solutions, and we propose that to all our partners or people who are not working with us yet. And it is up to them to decide if they want to try with us or not. We are not trying to convince anyone because this is not the way it works neither. That's what I think. But it's really difficult and it takes a lot of time to build this conversation. We have been quite in Sabah, at least. I mean, Sabah is a very interesting place for this because there is a lot of collaboration and communication going on between the few NGOs who are working on biodiversity and biodiversity conservation, between the government agencies as well, and a few of the private companies, including the palm oil industry. I mean, we all know each other, and little by little, I see that conversation is happening it's more easy now to have a conversation with this partner than it was 10 years ago, for example. And I think that there is no other way because, once again, we find elephants, we find orangutan in the landscape used by growers, by palm oil growers, and so forth. So we need to engage with them. And they need to engage with us, too, because what a grower don't want to see is an elephant or an orangutan being shot or dying in his own estate, because it's bad PR, it's bad publicity. So they don't know what to do with that. Of course, they are growers. They are not biologists and conservationists. So more and more, we see them engaging with groups like us to find long-term solutions.
Well, that's really promising to hear. I mean, at least there's conversations happening. At least they are open to listening to the scientific, you know, data that you have. What would you say are some of the successes that, you know, Hutan and KOCP have achieved so far?
Well, we are extremely proud. I'm extremely proud, actually, and able to see how far the people working with Hutan have been able to go. Since the time we started together 25 years ago, where there were people from the village without higher education. And today, most of them are able to do the research on their own. They follow the orangutan, they follow the elephant, they take the data, they process the data, they analyze the data, they produce a report. A lot of them have learned many, many things, many skills I don't even have. Some of them speak a better English than I. Some of them knows about statistics or mapping of things I don't know what to do. We have a team of professional educators now, but they were also from the village originally with no background on this, but they have been sent overseas and followed training and so forth. Some of our staff, they are the ones to be sent, not now, of course not, but before COVID, they were sent to attend international conferences and present the results of their work. Mm-hmm. This is what really makes us move. And I mean, to see that Bhutan is now really the result of a team of, we are 60 or 70 of us right now. Mm-hmm. But to see that this team is now really able to move on its own and to deliver a lot of information on their own, this is what really make us proud. And this is a nice, it has been a nice adventure for all of us. Very difficult sometimes, of course, but very rewarding at the end. For example, some of our teams are requested regularly by the industry, by other NGOs or the government to deliver training. And so mm-hmm. when you reach this stage where from trainee, these people become, these researchers become the trainers, and sometimes they train and they train actually regularly students from universities, local and international universities, knowing that none of our staff has any degree at all.
Wow.
And this is very rewarding to see.
You've got the knowledge all there, years and years of experience and on the ground work. But like you said, challenges still remain, right? And I'm sure COVID has, has COVID also impacted the work that you do? Has that presented a new challenge to everything that you're doing?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, as COVID is impacting everyone in Malaysia and internationally, one of our issues is that it has been extremely difficult for us to go in to the field, to do our field work because of the current SOPs and regulation. So it's really frustrating because, for example, we have a team planting trees and a team of ladies from the village. They are doing an outstanding job planting trees, doing reforestation to recreate corridors of forest inside this fragmented landscape. And we know that if you don't maintain the seedlings that have been planted for the first 3 years, for example, most of them will die. And of course, because of COVID, we were not able to go back to the field to do this maintenance. And we have lost, we know, at least 70% of all the seedlings that had been planted over the past couple of years. So it's a kind of thing that is really difficult because we know that we have to start again from scratch as soon as we can go back to the field. But there is no one to blame. This is COVID, isn't it? So these kind of things are an issue. But we try to look at the bright side of the picture. For example, our education team, I was just mentioning them earlier, they learned because of COVID to run education activities that are not physical anymore. So they have learned a lot of new ways to spread the message around using, of course, videos and the net and everything. So, yeah, we try to make the best out of the situation, whatever is the situation.
Yeah, I guess, that's the best all of us can do, right, under these circumstances. Yeah. I just want to focus a little bit on some of the orangutan research that you guys have been doing, right? I know that you co-authored a study released earlier this year, I think it was in February, and kind of alludes to what you were speaking about earlier. You know, it highlighted the importance of small fragments of forest amid landscape dominated by agriculture, right? And that was for the survival of orangutans in Southeast Asia. Tell me a little bit about this study and, you know, some of the main findings from it.
Yeah, so it's really interesting. So when we started the work, let me backlog a little bit. We started the work 25 years ago. Of course, orangutan, we all know that it means people of the forest. So of course, I thought orangutan needs a forest to survive.
Okay? Yeah.
And it's true, the species needs forest to survive. There is no forest, there is no orangutan. So what I thought at this time was that we would find orangutan in big forest only, and that this species couldn't survive in small, tiny fragments of forest, okay? And in Kinabatang, there was a lot of these small patches of forest. And so the first time I saw orangutan nest in this small, I mean, I'm speaking about small, like a few trees sometimes. I thought, well, it's really sad for the animals. They're gonna disappear because there is no way orangutan can live there. And over the years, we kept on seeing nests in some of these forest fragments. So this was really, really puzzling. And at the same time, we were following orangutan in the forest of the lower Kinabatangan Wildlife Sanctuary, and we realized that they were highly adaptable and able to survive in this habitat, very disturbed habitat. So we saw that the situation we were witnessing in these small patches of forest in the plantation deserved our attention. And we started to try to understand what was going on there. And so to make it short, what we found out, and this is something we are studying right now, is that some orangutans can survive in plantation as long as there is some patches of forest even there. Mm. And this is really new to science. No one would expect an orangutan to survive in a landscape dominated by palms, but some of them do. And so by looking at it more precisely, we realize that most of the animals who are resident, who are staying, who are living full-time in this plantation are females. Okay. They are most probably they are females who lost their forest when the plantation was set up, because females are territorial, so they stay there, and they stayed in whatever forest was left. And we have males going across the landscape, visiting these females, and sometimes they can breed. And so by doing interviews with the palm oil workers, we realize that some of these females have been known to be there for 20 years, some of them, and have been seen with babies on a regular basis. So the situation is that in Kinabatangan, and also in many other landscapes where we had done similar surveys now, most of the orangutan, of course, are found in the forest, but you have some individuals living outside of the forest in places that are dominated with palm oil plantation, acacia plantation, or timber plantation. And these animals are super important because they are the link between the larger population living in the forest that are protected. If we remove these animals, we isolate, we fragment even more the large population of orangutan. So you see what I mean? To allow for the genes to flow across the entire landscape, we really need to secure a future as well for these animals from the plantation. And this is new to science, and this is why we produced this paper a few months ago. It's not to say that orangutan are fine in a plantation, because of course they need the forest and they prefer the forest, and they cannot rely and survive on palms only. It's impossible for an orangutan. But acknowledging that we have a few individuals who are able to survive in the plantation is important for the industry to know about it, because now that the animals are within their land, they have to manage it. Orangutan is a fully protected species in Malaysia, and translocating the animals is not really working for orangutan. Mm. So the only viable option is to try to find ways for these growers to manage their own production and sustain their orangutan as well.
I just wanted to ask you about that point that you made, where you said that translocation is not always the best answer, right? I think what, when I read the report, what you said was it shouldn't be the default approach, but it has that very feel good sort of feeling, when you see it happening, right? Oh, okay, we're saving them from all this danger and putting them safely into the forest. But I know that I was reading it was another of your co-authors' reports who said that some of those that were taken from these altered landscapes were actually very healthy individuals, so there was no reason to translocate them as such. Is that correct?
Yes, and this is why this kind of research that is done by Hutan is so important, because until very recently, everybody, including us actually, thought when we have an orangutan in a plantation, poor animal, he's lost over there, he's going to die, so it's better to catch it and translocate it somewhere else. Mm. Because as you said, and it's very true, translocation or reintroduction is a kind of a feel-good exercise, because you see the results in front of your eyes. You catch something and you release it somewhere else, and wow, everybody's happy. Actually, it's what people think. It's not necessarily true. And I did a lot of this kind of work before moving to Malaysia. So for the longest time, we thought translocation is what needs to be done for orangutan, but we have two things now. First of all, we don't know how many orangutan are going to survive after translocation. And we know that females are extremely attached to the place where they were born. And most probably, if we move them outside of this place where they were born, where they have established their territory, move them to a new population where they don't know anyone, where they don't know where are the resources and so forth, most probably these females are going to die. Some of them will survive, but I think personally that most of them will die. Thing is, we don't have the data because it's extremely difficult to follow an orangutan. So when after the animals are translocated, you don't know what happens to them. Yeah. So this is one reason. We don't know the success rate of this translocation. It may be quite low, you know. But more importantly, as I just said before, we discussed it before. So we realized now that some of these animals can survive in the plantation as long as people don't shoot them or they are not attacked by dogs and so forth, and as long as there is enough food, okay? Mm. And these animals are key to maintain the connectivity between the larger population. And so if we remove them by translocating them, we remove the last fragment sometimes that is linking this population. So in terms of management of the meta population, what we call the meta population, the big population, it's actually a huge problem to translocate these animals. It would be much better to try to find ways to sustain these animals where they are. Having said that, it's true that translocation is a tool that can be used for conservation purposes. For example, if the forest where you have an orangutan is burning, well, it's better to translocate the animal rather than waiting and looking at this animal being burnt. Or if you have people who are endangering the life of the orangutan by shooting at it, of course, it's better to translocate it. But it shouldn't be translocation, shouldn't be the default approach. It should be the exception rather than the rules. And we need to come up with new ways of thinking about how to maintain this animal, this orangutan, within agriculture landscape. We need to speak more and to work more, and I know it's much more difficult. We need to work on coexistence practices. We need to find ways for orangutan to be sustained and maintain this palm oil plantation.
And that really needs everybody to play a very, very, you know, really work together, as you said. And also, you know, not to take it that doesn't mean that orangutans need forest to survive, because obviously they do. But there is a way to sort of all live together in this situation.
It's a complete paradigm shift that we are advocating for. Mm. Once again, we need protected forest and orangutan need forest. So cornerstone for the conservation of the species must remain creating more protected forest and connecting these protected forests together. This is necessary, but not sufficient when we think about the orangutan. And this is where we have to have this paradigm shift. We also need to think orangutan conservation in non-protected areas. So what to do to sustain orangutan, even if there are, of course, fewer animals maybe in this landscape than in the forest, but there are importance is crucial to sustain the entire population. Mm. So what needs to be done to sustain these animals in this kind of landscape? This is new to conservation, because until recently, we were really not focusing. Conservationists were not focusing their time and their thinking and their resources on this situation. But it's necessary to also work in these non-protected areas.
Okay. And is that sort of what, you know, Hutan is going to continue working towards, you know, counseling, you know, towards the communities, industrial players, governments? Is this sort of the track that you're going to be taking?
Yeah, I mean, because we are operating in these multiple use landscapes, so where you have different types of stakeholders. So, of course, we need to better understand the dynamic and the relationship between the different species and between people's activities and biodiversity. And here again, need to listen to the different stakeholders. So in this case, it includes the palm oil grower and what are their issues, their aspirations, and so forth, and how together can we move forward. And it's a long-term process for sure, but this is a necessary one, because the palm oil industry is not going to go. And if the palm oil industry is going away, something else will come anyway. The thing is, we are dealing with a species, the orangutan, which is very resilient. So it's a good news, actually, for the species itself, because this means that it might be possible to find ways for the orangutan to survive inside these non-protected areas. Having said that, a lot of species cannot survive in plantation. Having said that, plantations have been responsible and are still responsible for a lot of destruction as well. We have to recognize all of these things. But in the case of Kinabatangan, we cannot secure the orangutan population living over there without the support of the palm oil industry. So it's as simple as that. For me, I want to protect. I want to try to do my best to secure a future for the orangutan in Kinabatangan. I have to engage with the palm oil industry.
Okay. All right. So your work is cut out for you, no doubt. And, you know, for anyone who's listening, right, and they're interested in orangutan conservation, what would you say they can do to contribute? You know, are some methods more effective and useful than others? You know, there's a lot of calls to boycott palm oil, for example. Do you think things like that is effective?
No, I don't think that boycotting per se is really useful. It may have been useful in the past to draw and to draw the attention to a problem, which was forest destruction in Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. But at UTAN, we are not promoting boycott at all, because I don't think it will work. What we are promoting, though, is sustainable practices, so certification. So we can speak about MSPO, RSPO. UTAN has been a member of RSPO for the longest time. Why? Because, once again, I think that the only way is to improve practices on the ground. And this holds true for everything, not only palm oil, but production of colza, corn, wheat, if we speak about cereals, but production of fish and so forth. All what people are producing need to be better produced to minimize our impact on the environment, because this is a global issue. It's not actually just palm oil and orangutan, it's really a global issue. We are putting it together. I mean, and we know now that what's happening with climate change, with forest fires, with flood, with disease, I mean, you name this, this is happening now. It won't happen. I mean, it will happen in 10 years or so, but it has already started.
Yeah,
it's not too late to act, but we cannot wait any longer. And so people are already using so much of the land resources. We need to produce better. And to me, one way, it's not the only one, and it's not a perfect way, but one way is certification. Because at least when you go for sustainable practice that are certified by an independent body, so for palm oil could be RSPO, for timber could be FSC and so forth. Well, at least you know that these industries are trying to improve their management practices. So this is why when we engage with the palm oil industry, we also engage with RSPO to try to combine the need of a species like the orangutan to survive in these landscapes with what could be the best practices for the agriculture, for this sector, to produce their oil, but also not to protect, but to better manage the environment and the ecosystem. So certification is one way forward. So for all of us as consumers, of course, we have our role to play by not boycotting necessarily the products, but trying to buy only certified product or product made with certified commodities. Mm-hmm. So it's one thing we can do. I have another message, which is more for the younger people, the younger Malaysian. Mm-hmm. We need you. We need you on the ground. We need more people doing this kind of work if we want to secure a future for wildlife, not only the orangutan, but any type of species and ecosystem. We need more conservationists. This is really something, especially for the younger generation, the younger people who go to the university, or even without going to university, it's not a big deal. We need more people on the ground. We need more people to do things, to really commit themselves, to commit their life, their career for conservation. You are definitely needed and welcome. And something else that everyone can do is to really listen to what's happening over there, listen to people who speak at your channel, read, but be careful to what you read, because sometimes a lot of things in the news that are not necessarily true. But anyway, what is really important is for people to start speaking about these issues around themselves. We will be able to make a difference only when the majority of people is aware of what's going on. The destruction of the biodiversity is not happening only in Malaysia, it's happening worldwide. We are, as I said, all of us are in it together. We are all responsible for it to some extent. But we need to, there are ways to improve the situation. We can do it. Sorry, I was a bit going away from your question.
Not at all.
It's not too late, but we have to act now. Yeah. And when I look at, this is my personal experience, when I look at how resilient nature can be, you know what? I'm not really concerned about nature. I'm not really concerned about biodiversity. My concern is about us, is about people. Because no matter what, one species that will go extinct at some point if we don't stop our behavior is us. Nature will never go extinct. There will be something else that will take over. But I'm really concerned about our own species, because when I see all this non-sustainable use of our resources, this is what worries me.
Everything we do is going to come back to impact us, you know.
Exactly.
Eventually. Yeah. Well,
you're a very shorter way to put it that way.
Well, thank you so much, you know, for speaking with me today, Mark. And, you know, if anyone is listening and they'd like to get in touch or they'd like to support the work that you do, what's the best way that they can do that?
As I said, I mean, speak about all of this thing around you. This is very important. You can visit our website. There's a lot of information there. Mm-hmm. When tourism will be open again, Kinabatangan is really a hot spot for tourism, and we are supporting local tourism over there. I mean, Bhutan is not doing tourism. We don't have an ecotourism branch, but we work a lot with community members who have their own bed and breakfast and so forth. So it's a neat way to really come to a place as a tourist to see wildlife, to see communities and to share the life of a community in Sukar or those villages, Abai, Bibit, and so forth. And to see that indeed, this is not a dream I was talking about earlier. I mean, it's possible for people and wildlife to coexist. It's just a matter of will. And the question at the end is, are we ready ourselves to coexist with wildlife? And it's a question I would like to ask all of you who are listening now. I've been talking about elephants or orangutan. And of course, if you are living, let's say, in Kuala Lumpur, you are not really directly concerned about elephant and orangutan coexistence. Mm-hmm. Okay? But ask yourself, are you ready to coexist with a gecko, for example, in your flat, or with a spider, or with a snake in your backyard? At the end of the day, it's the same question we need to ask ourselves. There is a future for biodiversity only if people, us, agree to coexist with these animals. And I think this is one of the major challenges we're going to have to face, and we are already facing in this century.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that is a question, and that is, and hopefully people have the right answer to that. But, you know, if anyone is interested, you know, do head to hutan.org.my for more information if you'd like to know about the work that Hutan does. And if you miss any part of today's interview, you can always download the podcast at bfm.my/earth or on the BFM app. And my thanks again to Dr. Mark Ankrenas. He is the scientific director of Hutan and the co-director of the Kinabatangan Orang Utan Conservation Project. And this has been Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.